everyone to the House Judiciary Committee. I apologize for my tardiness. I had the privilege of welcoming the procession from Ecumenical Ministries and the Interfaith Council of Greater Portland to the Capitol just a few moments ago, and they'll be lobbying communicating with members throughout the afternoon, so I hope we get an opportunity to speak to that group as they come by to visit you. We are going to open this afternoon with some invited testimony throughout the afternoon. You can see, committee, that we've got a long list of presenters today to continue our third day on the discussion of medical liability reform issues. So at this time, I'd like to bring up Kevin Mannix, who is here. It's good to see you, Representative, and Senator Mannix worked long years on judiciary committees and in working on various proposals through the legislature, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to the committee this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce one of my associates, Chris Bishop. Mr. Bishop did a lot of work, in fact, most of the work on the study here. He was the editor of the study that we'll be talking about this afternoon. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll have him stay up here with me in case there's some questions later on that he could help with.
That would be just fine.
Thank you.
I jokingly refer to Chris, who is a very tall, strapping fellow, as my bodyguard, but he actually is my associate.
I'm not strapping.
Another one of my associates is also here today, mainly to observe, and that's John Wooten, growing his Fu Manchu beard there, and he's in the row right behind me.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that you have a lot to chew on in terms of the question of medical malpractice litigation in the state of Oregon, the problems, the cause of the problems, potential solutions, and I'm not here today to proselytize about who's to blame, but to simply make the observation that there are challenges that confront medical practitioners in the state. They particularly confront those who practice in the OBGYN area, and you've heard enough from others to understand that there is a problem and an issue out there, and the question will be what kind of solution can Oregon bring forward, and should it be a targeted solution for one part of the medical malpractice arena, or should it be for the entire arena, or is it something that should be even broader than that? I come to you today with three different documents, one of which is a study that's been conducted by my law firm entitled A Study of a No-Fault Medical Injury Claims System to Replace Litigation. This is something that we've been studying actually since December, and Chris Bishop was the editor of the study. We finished this report actually just yesterday, in the nick of time, if you will, so as to present it to this committee. The study was put together because on a campaign trail last year, I was reminded repeatedly by medical providers, largely OBGYN physicians, but also others in the medical profession, that they believed that they were being driven from the practice of medicine. And again, separate from what may have been causing it, their problem was that their medical malpractice premiums were skyrocketing, and they felt that they could not afford to pay those premiums and to continue to practice either in a particular geographic area or more significantly in the OBGYN area. I'm not an expert on that problem, and I'll leave it up to the committee to decide what their discernment is as to the extent of that problem. But what we did was say, well, let's assume for purposes of discussion that there is a problem out there and that it is the threat of litigation that is part of the problem. You'll see in the study that we are non-judgmental about whether or not you can blame it on insurance companies or blame it on lawyers or blame it on litigants. Let's step back from that. Is there an alternative that would reduce some of the pressures that are out there? Now, the second document that I've presented to you is simply entitled A Proposal for a No-Fault Medical Injury Claim System for Oregon. That's a five-page document, and that is really what I'll be talking about this afternoon. The study that I refer to provides you with a wealth of background information, which I think you will find very helpful in analyzing constitutional issues, both at the federal level and the state level. Taking a look at what a couple of other states have done, in particular Virginia and Florida, and also taking a look at what Sweden did many, many years ago to limit their own system of litigation potential as to what I'll call medical injury claims. The outline that you have in front of you is simply a set of bullet points that we put together for the convenience of the committee members. It's a front and back copy, outline no-fault medical injury claim system proposal, and that's designed to give you an overview as to what I call it version 1.0, the first version of an idea about an alternative system, where Oregon could lead the way in being even more creative than Virginia and Florida, more aggressive than Virginia and Florida, but also sensitive to the Oregon Supreme Court's decision, which guarantees the right to access to courts and guarantees the right to a jury trial. The essence of this proposal is simply this, that you turn to the contractual opportunities that individuals have. You can contract out of the right to a jury trial. You can contract right out of the right to sue. But in so doing, one would be concerned that if someone simply wrote such a contract, that it might be seen as a violation of public policy because it might be seen as a contract of adhesion. Is there some big insurance company or some clinic that's having this poor patient or insured sign off and sign away all of their rights to a trial by jury and to access to the courts in exchange for what? Instead, the proposal is that the state of Oregon institutionalize what the contractual outline ought to include and actually mandate some elements of such a contract so as to protect, in particular, potential claimants, but also to make sure that the system is set up in a fair and balanced manner so that those who have more economic power, the insurers and the medical providers, are balanced against a claimant who has a right of access to an alternative system. The alternative system that is offered here is basically an arbitration system, but it's an arbitration system where you don't have to prove fault. And one of the biggest problems, I think, with the medical malpractice field is the very title, medical malpractice. Physicians hate that label. Does this mean I've done something wrong? Mal, from Spanish or Latin? The Spanish would be malo. I'm not sure what it would be in Latin, but mal is bad. Bad practice. And the essence of it is a message at the beginning that we're going after somebody for bad practices. The reality is that any physician, any medical provider, could be acting completely according to professional standards and still have something go wrong because things go wrong. Could still have a problem occur because problems occur. Even with medication, at some point there's a certain percentage of instances where you will have side effects. And it's predictable that for a given medication with a given population that a certain percentage will have a certain type of side effect. Is that malpractice to have prescribed that medication? Well, we get beyond that issue by simply saying if there was a medical injury, meaning something went wrong so as to cause you some sort of physical harm, that we're not worried in this system as to whose fault it was in terms of allowing a claim or disallowing a claim. The trade-off is you will not have to prove fault in exchange for agreeing to have entered into a system, which is a type of arbitration system. And what you've waived is your right to go to court directly. You've waived your right to trial by jury. But in exchange for that, you've been given a system where you simply file a claim. It's an administrative process. And if your claim is accepted, certain benefits are automatically provided based on whatever medical injury occurred and whatever ramifications there may be to that medical injury. The closest parallel is the workers' compensation system, which is a no-fault system, where if it arises out in the course of employment, hey, then it's compensable, it's covered. And in fact, we rely on the workers' compensation system in this proposal as the system that you would turn to in terms of your temporary disability, that is wage loss situations, and in terms of any permanent disability that may arise out of the injury. By moving into that system, you're able to assure anybody who is signing up for this, say, when they sign up for their health insurance, or signing up for it when they're going to a medical provider, that if something goes wrong, they don't have to prove that Dr. X committed medical malpractice, or that the doctor's nurse committed malpractice, or that the hospital did it. Something went wrong. Take care of me. Take care of my medical injury. Provide me with the appropriate benefits. But in exchange for that, I'm not going into court to seek pain and suffering recovery, and I'm not seeking punitive damages. I am seeking the guarantee of a recovery for the problem in terms of my medical injury, and a guarantee that if I had time loss, temporary disability, that will be taken care of automatically, that if there is any impairment that's associated with, that will be taken care of automatically under, we suggest, the same schedule as you use for workers' compensation benefits. We use that because it's an existing system that's been litigated a lot, and where you do have clear definitions as to what needs to be paid out. We propose this system be kept as simple as possible, that you not establish a new government agency to run it, but instead allow the private sector to respond to the solution and see if medical providers will set up a claim system or if insurance companies will come in and set up a claim system. And the idea is to also say that this arbitration hearing is at no cost to the claimant. If the claimant is unhappy with the process and requests arbitration, that process is provided at the cost of the medical provider or the insurer. If there is a decision by an arbitrator that is felt to be inappropriate, you can seek review by a panel of three arbiters. But in seeking that review, understand that they are limited to the record that's already been created, and they look at substantial evidence to support the decision, substantial reasoning to support the conclusions, which, by the way, is a parallel to what's done with administrative law review. We're trying to borrow from other concepts of the law. This can be limited, if the committee so chooses, to the area of OBGYN practice, if that is the hot spot that you want to focus on. And I understand that if you're trying something new, you may want to do that. At the same time, if it's limited to OBGYN, you may not have enough practitioners and insurers willing to come in and devise something for this market. The most important thing, though, is that this can't be done in a vacuum. If this kind of system is to be put into effect, it really does need a statutory framework to be fair and balanced, to address the legitimate issues that arise out of this new approach, and to make sure, too, that those who engage in the system understand that you have given your public policy seal of approval. If someone tried to do this system on their own, and they could do a lot of this through contractual principles right now, what they would run up against is a fear that someone would challenge them in court, claim that this is a violation of public policy for a variety of reasons, because it's something novel, it's something that's not been tried out, and I don't think you can get the private sector to step in to do it, unless the legislature has laid out a pattern and said, if you follow this pattern, you can have this alternative system, an arbitration system, in effect, for medical injury claims. I want to add one other thing. Please note that you don't shift into arbitration unless a claim is denied. There's an assumption here that very many of these claims will simply be accepted and benefits will be provided. Just as in the workers' compensation system, last time I checked, about 85% of the claims are accepted and processed and taken care of. There's about, I haven't looked, it could be 12 to 15% of the claims. There's a challenge. There's an administrative litigation process. And you can assume that I think that the vast majority of medical injury claims will be taken care of. The final issue that needs to be addressed is, well, what about medical malpractice? What if the practitioner really did botch something and we need to take remedial action? This proposal calls for any claim to be reported to the appropriate licensing authority so that they and it requires that they have access to all the records of the claim so they can review it and see if there's an indication of non-professional conduct by a medical provider. And that allows them to intervene from a licensing and supervision standpoint, and you separate the malpractice concept from the fact that a medical injury has occurred in terms of how you process things, but you make sure that the system is comprehensive so that both aspects can be addressed. Now, this is the first presentation you've had on this. You haven't had a chance to read any of these documents. I present it to you at first blush as a thinking piece, and I will pause at this point and say thank you for the opportunity to come in front of you, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. It's always hard to figure out what to call you these days, Kevin. But former Representative Mannix, I think, would be appropriate in front of this committee. And we do appreciate you coming forward with this idea and concept and the effort that you've put into providing the committee some interesting information. I think there are questions. If I can ask the first one, then I'm happy to let my committee have at it. I was interested in the states where this has been to some limited degree tested or experienced, what your sense about their experience with the proposal or how it varied from what you're proposing, if you can maybe enlighten us a little bit with that material.
And with your permission, since Chris brought Virginia and Florida to my attention, if I may I have him respond?
Absolutely.
Chris?
Mr. Chair, Committee, for the record, my name is Chris Bishop, and I'm an attorney with Kevin Mannix Law Firm. The difference between, so far from what I can tell, there's two states that have implemented a limited no-fault system within their state. And those states are Virginia and Florida, and they both did it within the late 1980s. And both states have limited their no-fault system to injuries that have occurred during the practice of basically the delivery of babies. It applies to obstetricians. If you go to the study, there's a whole section on there where we focused on the Virginia and the Florida system. And one of the things that we found is that the system has compensated more injured patients than the traditional tort system in those two states. However, what we did also find is that when those systems were implemented, they were not given much guidance from the state legislature at the time. And so, for example, they weren't given much guidance as to what was a reasonable and necessary medical expense, and they were compensating people for trips to Europe to see a doctor for therapeutic reasons and things like that. So if you were to look into a no-fault system here in Oregon, obviously what we suggest is that you set forth specific guidelines on certain things like that. I don't know if that was responsive, Mr. Chair, but it's kind of in a nutshell, and the study sets forth those two systems in great detail.
Yes, that's very helpful, and I'll be interested to read of their experience. Have there been any published studies, are you aware, by either folks in Florida or Virginia analyzing their systems?
Mr. Chair, yes. Most of the studies that I have found have been from legal scholars and medical doctors. I've tried to contact
anybody those. Independent?
There are some independent studies that have been performed.
Okay.
I found a few studies, and I've cited those in the study, where the states themselves have done a review of their system after it's like a 10-year, 15-year review of their system and had made some recommended changes to those systems. Mm-hmm. Specifically, Virginia has made a major overhaul to their system after a 10-year study.
Okay.
So those are cited, too, in the report.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Very helpful. Representative Przanski?
Thank you, Kevin. Welcome back. One question, looking at the suggestion that you have for the no-fault and maybe potentially limiting it to the area of OGYBN, how have other states or have they set up some type of value for the injuries that are being claimed? And specifically, I wonder regarding the infants that are basically, let's say, suffering these injuries and how they value the injury and their life. Or claim for life, and is it limited to recovery through the guardian or the parent?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, I'll answer part of the question, and then I'll ask Chris to pick up if I may. First of all, what we've tried to do with our proposal is to rely on the workers' compensation system, because even with an infant, if there's any permanent impairment, you can then extrapolate from that what kind of limitations there will be, and there is an award schedule for impairment, as well as if there's a loss of earning capacity, although that's very hard to estimate with an infant. There's also death benefits which are allowed under workers' compensation, which you can then parallel. So I tried to replicate a system, or we try to replicate a system that's known in Oregon in terms of what benefits are available. But I'll now let Chris answer as to what Virginia and Florida did.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, both Virginia and Florida, I don't know specifically what you're looking at, but what they've done, if you go to page 11 on the study, what they've done is they've gone through and they compensate everything that's medically and necessary and a reasonable expense. So they compensate all the medical expenses that incur, whether it be at the time of delivery or any medical expense that comes after that, whether it be through treatment or care of some sort. And then the states kind of differ as to what they do as far as further compensation goes. For example, it's Florida. Florida's, they have a $100,000, what they call $100,000 parental payment, and it's a one-time lump sum payment, which is basically a substitute for payments for pain and suffering, which they pay to the legal guardian or the parent of the child. And as far as other payments go, I do not believe there's Virginia, sorry. There is one difference also between the two systems. In Virginia, it does compensate for lost wages. In Florida, they do not. Virginia compensates for 50% of the average wage for those working from ages 18 through 65.
And if I may add to that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, what we are, in our first version of this proposal, we're suggesting that in terms of any medical injury claim, the injured person, whether it's an infant or an adult, there's no distinction in this proposal at this point, would receive temporary disability benefits as well as permanent disability benefits. But we also provide that the parents of a child who need to take time off to care for a child, whether it's an infant or an older child, would be compensated also for their lost wages during the time that they had to care for the child.
If I could, Mr. Chair, if I could clarify one more point. I think this will speak to your question. They do not have, in either Virginia or Florida, they do not have a schedule of benefits, per se, like you'd see in the workers' compensation system. What they do have is a periodic payment as that infant incurs medical charges throughout his or her lifetime. Does that make sense?
Thank you both.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, to either of our witnesses, I note on page 2 that under this plan, the workers' compensation system of disability rating shall be used to determine the award amount. And some of the injuries we saw yesterday, it appears to me that these were severe neurological types of injuries, that these would qualify as unscheduled permanent partial disability under the workers' compensation law. I tried to calculate the formula for the compensation in those types of cases, but it's too complicated for me to do very quickly right here. Do you have any idea what the cap would be on that type of injury? A full 320 degrees unscheduled permanent partial disability under the workers' compensation scheme.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, the short answer is I'm not sure, because I usually don't have to calculate that anymore in my litigation, and I've leave that to others. In fact, it's a very small part of my practice anymore. But the so I can't give you the maximum cap. But 320 degrees, if the last time I looked at the value, you may be talking about, I don't even want to say the figure other than it's several hundred dollars per degree, and there's usually it's claims examiners who go through that calculation. And there's very few extended disability cases that are litigated, at least by my firm anymore, so I couldn't tell you what the value is. I will tell you that you jump from that to permanent total disability, which is a lifetime monthly payment, and that permanent total disability is also possible to be compensated under the system. So I wouldn't call it a cap so much. If someone is still capable of working, it's one thing. That's permanent partial disability. But if they're unable to engage in reasonable employment, then it becomes permanent total disability. And that was simply an idea here for, again, a methodology for compensating persons for the loss of earning capacity.
May one follow up?
You may.
That brings me to my second question, which would be, of course, a permanent total disability situation in which the award would be converted into a monthly payment. However, on page 3, is it your intent that such awards would be offset by disability insurance, workers' compensation, and you don't mention things like Social Security or PERS disability benefits. So do you contemplate that that would be offset against a permanent total award?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, that's what this proposal says, but it's truly a proposal, and I expect that there will be a lot of debate about which offsets are appropriate and which are not. The workers' compensation parallel is good because if someone is receiving workers' compensation benefits for the very same situation, then it would be a one-on-one offset, and it's something that would have been covered under workers' compensation in the first place. But that will be an area for ample debate, I'm sure, as to what offsets ought to be allowed. We came in with this idea for these offsets because that's often the kinds of offsets you use when you're talking about an agreement, a contractual agreement for an arbitration process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, in the study, in the appendix, I've included a state-by-state comparison. And in that state-by-state comparison, it shows the laws in the different states and what they allow as far as collateral sources for offsets. So that will give the committee a good idea of where states are at as far as that goes.
Would it be your opinion, then, that under the scheme you're proposing, that in terms of catastrophic injuries, that the amount that would come out of a system of this nature would be below $250,000 per claim?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I don't know. In terms of a catastrophic injury, if you relied on the workers' compensation system, and if you're looking at permanent partial disability and then permanent total disability, if you separate out the medical services and the temporary disability, I'd say the answer is probably yes. If you include the others, the medical services can be inconsequential on the one hand, and they could be $1 million in a very serious claim. And there is no cap here in terms of time frame for medical services. It could be lifetime medical services. I think that the gist of your interpretation would be largely correct for most medical injury claims.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Yes, Representative Zansky.
Kevin, I'm not that familiar with the workers' comp. I know that there's some type of schedule. I believe there's some type of schedule for attorney fees. Could you please elaborate under this proposal how an attorney, that I would assume in many cases claimants would maybe feel more comfortable or feel like their rights may be better protected by retaining a counsel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Przanski, the attorney fee provisions here have more to do with the, in terms of the arbitration process, there is no specific provision for attorney fees one way or another. The idea is to allow first the claim to be processed, and that clearly does not involve attorney fees. If claims allowed, you don't need a lawyer, you're taken care of, and it's processed. There will be a question then as to whether or not there ought to be attorney fees for the arbitration process. And right now, we've clearly proposed that the arbitration process be paid for by the medical provider or by the insurer. Whoever's administering the system should pay for that. And as to attorney fees for a claimant who says, I need arbitration, and I go into arbitration, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, because I don't think we included any specific provision in the proposal. And I'm looking to Chris to see if he can correct me on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, we have kind of left that open for the committee to decide. In looking at the Swedish system and the other states, what they have done is they've compensated the attorney for their reasonable time and not necessarily based upon a contingency fee.
Yes, Representative Krummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Former Representative Mannix, in the study, and maybe Chris would answer this better, but either one of you, in the study on the chart in the back that shows the liability reforms, I was noting for California that it shows the caps and that sort of thing. Is that based on the MICRA legislation that was passed, I guess, in the mid-70s, or is that based on the Prop 103 that was passed in the mid-80s? Or is it a combination of the two?
I'll defer to you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, I believe that is based upon MICRA, which was passed in 1975. I think that was included in the original legislation.
Okay. Follow-up, if I may, Mr.
Yes.
Chair? I actually have, well, anyway, with regards to Prop 3, I guess it's 103, I think is the number. We were given a presentation on that yesterday by a fellow from somewhere in California. And I was wondering if you had looked at that in terms of the differences that it made in the California system and whether I was trying to figure out if what you were proposing was sort of contemplating some of those changes as well.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'll have Chris answer the background, and then I'll have a further comment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, I have not done an in-depth study of Proposition 103. What I can tell you is I have listened to the arguments given before United States Congress on this issue. I understand that similar testimony was given yesterday before this committee, and it is debatable whether it was Prop 103 or whether it was MICRA that had led to the decrease in insurance rates in California. I read a study this morning that was released last week by the Department of Human Services, and they their conclusion is that Prop 103 had some sort of effect in reducing their overall insurance rates, but that combined with the caps basically helped it out.
Okay.
So,
and Mr. Chairman, Representative Krummel, as a supplement to that, when we went into this, we didn't do this from a financial or fiscal perspective. We were looking at what is an alternative that's available to provide prompt access to resolution of claims, prompt remediation where there's a medical injury so that things are taken care of. What kind of a system can we have where there will be openness? so that it's very open as, hey, something went wrong here, let's take care of it, at the same time guaranteeing that it's brought to the attention of the licensing authority and it's not covered up. If there's a claim that there's a medical problem here, let's understand that and take a look at whether or not there's something wrong in terms of the techniques being used in the practice. And we'll leave it to others to figure out the economic calculation. But certainly there are limits on the kinds of benefits that you can receive if you're not receiving a pain and suffering or punitive damages. That's a substantial trade-off. From a philosophical perspective, in presenting this, my thinking was that the trade-off is worth it because you're guaranteeing an easier access to a remedy, and you're guaranteeing that no fault need be shown, so that a claimant who is injured doesn't have to go through that process and is taken care of immediately in a claims process. Not a perfect process, because anything that we've designed isn't perfect, but at least it gives you much quicker and, I think, fuller access to a remedy. And I think, is it Virginia that the statistics show that more people benefited from having a claims process available as opposed to having to go through litigation to get a recovery?
Okay. And may I ask one more
question? Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3 under administration, in the first couple of paragraphs, it talks about the ways that a person would enter the system. And I'm just curious, does the proposal contemplate then that at the time that the person is initially seeking treatment, or at the time that they initially sign an insurance plan, that they would be sort of signing this waiver to go into arbitration in the no-fault system? And secondly, does that create any kind of a constitutional issue or any other issue from the standpoint of somebody waiving something that they, you know, is it going to be represented that they're waiving something that they've never possessed, so they can't waive it in the first place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, actually the idea is that at the time you start receiving care from a particular provider, or when you're signed up for health insurance, you're given an opportunity, you're presented with, and this is where the statutory part is important, information about what the plan is about, and you're signing off saying, I agree that I'm going to be in the system, and I understand I'm giving up my right to a trial by jury and my right to litigate in exchange for the system, and I agree to proceed on that basis. So it's got to be, in effect, a knowing waiver. As long as there's balance and it's a publicly established system under a statute, I think you can meet constitutional standards about making sure that someone's rights are protected, that they have not unknowingly waived their rights of access to the courts or to the right to a jury trial. And it's important that the statutory scheme be very clear about how that is achieved.
Thank you. If I may interject just one thing, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell. In this study, we have included statutory provisions from California and 3 other states where they do allow these sort of contracts. And they have avoided constitutional problems. And in there, you'll read the different things that they do. And some of the things that they consider is notice in the language and the typeface of the language on the agreement. And some states even allow the patient to revoke the agreement after a certain period of time. So there are certain things you can consider.
Thank you.
Further, yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the no-fault part of it, but I just wonder, the two parties have no fault with each other. Are there any ramifications or repercussions to the medical provider as far as his insurance in any of these states that have done this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the idea is, by in effect channeling claims and defining exposure more carefully, to reduce the cost of coverage and to encourage insurers to provide coverage with a no-fault system of this kind, where because there will be more predictability about the kinds of benefits that are provided, because they can go take a look at their experiences, say, in workers' compensation and other systems, and put that all together to reduce the cost of what I would call malpractice insurance in the current milieu, but which would have a new title, I would think. And the idea is that physicians will feel freer to continue providing services because the cost of the insurance coverage will go down. In terms of the experience in Virginia and Florida, I'm going to ask Chris to respond to that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson. The experience in Florida and Virginia is that the insurance rates have actually decreased since they've implemented their no-fault schemes there. So.
Yes, you may follow up.
So the real repercussion would be in the fact that the records would go back to the peer reviews, and anything that was taken out against the provider would really be on his medical experience with his peers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, yes, and in fact, I would pose the proposition that you will have more routine review then of what's going on, because it will be much easier to present a medical injury claim, which will automatically be reviewed each time such a claim is made.
Let me follow up on that, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, in Virginia and Florida, I think you're getting to the experience-based rating for insurance premiums, and what those states have done is that those medical providers who have had fewer claims since the no-fault system has been implemented, their insurance premiums have dropped. And those who have had claims, their insurance premiums have increased slightly. But overall, the system ratings have decreased.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, may I wrap up?
You please. Yes, you may.
The study itself is meant to be comprehensive and does not include a proposal. I think that you can use this as an extremely helpful guide to what's been going on. We spent a long time conducting this study. The proposal is something developed over the last couple of weeks after reviewing the study, thinking about it, and coming forward. And that obviously is shorter. We call it version 1.0 for a reason. It's not set in stone. It's designed to be a think piece that people can, I hope, work from and debate about. And we will be happy to make ourselves available to assist the committee. Normally, I would have provided at least the chair with an advance copy, but we really turned on the burners to get this finished in time because the chair asked me to come make a presentation. So I would have preferred to have given it to you well in advance to give you a chance to review it. And I'd like to also mention to you something. I was just waiting for somebody to ask me who paid for this report. This was not paid for by any insurance company. It was not paid for by anybody involved in the healthcare industry. A private business client of my firm, and I'll exclude for public purposes, and I'm not talking about Lauren Parks of an Aloha or his company, but a private business client asked me to conduct a study because that business person thought we needed someone to take a look at the medical malpractice arena, and I believe really did it from a public policy perspective, and asked me to estimate what it would cost, and we said, this is what it would cost. I said, go ahead and do the study, and really didn't know exactly where we would end up presenting it, but here it is today.
Representative Chevrolet.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Irrespective of where it came from, Kevin, I think it's an intriguing and obviously well-researched proposal. I appreciate you bringing it forward in this. It's helpful. I think so far we've rehashed the arguments that we've heard, not we, but speaking of this body, have probably heard 10 times over the past 30 years it's exaggerated, but we've heard a lot of the same kind of arguments both sides. And it's helpful to get a fresh perspective some new information into the debate.
May I add one other thought, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
While we were doing this, I remembered my days in law school because there were some attempts at the time to have no-fault auto insurance, which have basically failed. And I thought, well, why would this be successful before we'd even looked at Virginia and Florida? What would be different? And what's different is with auto insurance, you're going against a stranger who did something that clearly led to an accident, and there can be emotion, but you didn't have a relationship in most cases before it happened. Well, with medical coverage, you have a relationship with your employer, the health insurer, the medical provider you're dealing with, unless we're in the emergency department, that might be the one exception. But you're talking about an ongoing relationship where you can, in repose, consider whether you want to engage in these trade-offs. The no-fault system was imposed on people for autos, and a lot of people said, darn it, I want the right to sue this guy, this did this to me, et cetera. Who is this stranger who hurt me? We have a different milieu here that we're dealing with, and I think that's why it's a healthy discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much, Kevin, and for the efforts that you put into meeting the committee's deadline and providing us some interesting information. Thank you. Next up, We're going to move past the group set for 124, and that'll put us almost back on time. We're going to move to the 148 proposal. That's procedural considerations from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, Bill Syme and Jim Edmonds. They're going to take attendance. Right. That's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Syme and members of the committee. I'm a member of the board for the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. With me is James Edmonds, who is president of that organization. We are both lawyers in private practice here in Salem, and I think we both practiced about 20 years or so. We're here to express kind of some of the observations of our group in this whole process. Now, we're an association of over 500 lawyers who primarily defend individuals and companies in civil litigation, and a fair number of our members represent doctors and hospitals in medical legal issues and also in the defense of malpractice cases, and that is also a portion of my practice as well. So we think we have kind of a unique perspective to some of this discussion. I have not heard any of the testimony of the proponents of some of the tort reform measures on Monday, nor of the opponents who testified yesterday or their observations. And I just want to make clear before this committee that we're not here on behalf of the physicians. We're not here on behalf of the hospitals or the insurers. But our real interest is in the integrity of the civil trial system and civil jury trial system. And that's what our concern is. And we're here basically as amicus curiae, friends of the court, friends of the committee, and to offer some unique observations, I think. And first of all, I'd like to observe that I think that the system, the civil trial system, is alive and well and is not in need of substantial tort reform. And this may come as a surprise to some of you to hear that message come from a group of defense lawyers when you're having tort reform bills that are under consideration. But I think that is reality. And I know that this next message is a little bit off target or a little bit off point, but in order to ensure the smooth operation of the civil trial system, I think that this committee and the members of the legislature need to establish as a high priority the adequate and continued funding of our court systems and ways to attract and retain qualified judges and ways to preserve the right to jury trial. Now, there obviously is a problem. You've heard from people who can articulate that problem far better than I on Monday in the medical malpractice arena, and the trend to rising insurance premiums and some of the problems that are caused by that, which I think does create a substantial problem with health care delivery in this state. And this committee has and this legislature has, I think, a very clear and legitimate state interest in addressing some of those problems. These medical malpractice cases are very difficult to present. They are time-consuming and expensive. You have to hire experts to do that. They are very expensive and time-consuming to defend. You also have to hire the experts. Essentially, though, the system and the process is working well. But that isn't really what your debate is about. Your debate is about health care delivery and keeping and retaining physicians in practice in certainly particular specialty areas and certainly particular areas of the state where we are, in fact, losing physicians. The single most important thing that you could do if you get there, I think, to address that situation would be the enactment of a cap on non-economic damages in personal injury cases. But as you, I'm sure, have been advised, the Oregon Supreme Court has addressed that issue under current statute. It's held that that cap on non-economic damages is unconstitutional. And before we could ever do anything to address that point, there'd have to be a change in the Oregon Constitution. Candidly, the rest of this tort reform package, or most of it, you're basically dealing with things around the fringes, such as a cap on or regulating the amount of attorney's fees that could be recovered, requiring periodic payments of awards for future payments for economic loss, putting caps on certain types of interest in medical malpractice cases. I don't have any of the empirical data to tell you that that's going to do much good or how that's going to affect the insurance premiums or health care delivery in the state. That's ultimately going to be a judgment that your committee is going to make, And our organization does not take any position on that. There are a couple things I think that are important in this package for consideration. One is the concept of expert disclosure and limited expert discovery. This is something that's not in agreement among the plaintiff's lawyers, among the plaintiff's lawyers themselves, and certainly not in unanimous agreement among the members of our organization. But it's something that we as an organization, I think, are prepared to support and would advocate, because that does, particularly in the larger cases, promote, I think, a better and more orderly handling of the case and a better and more orderly trial function, and I think a better result at trial. The Oregon is, I think, unique in most states in that we do not have expert disclosure. I think the vast majority of the states do. I can't tell you the exact number. Certainly in federal court they have expert discovery and disclosure. In the small cases, the automobile accident cases here in Oregon, you know, maybe that's not appropriate. But certainly in substantial cases of medical malpractice, as you are defending those cases or presenting them, that is appropriate. And in the substantial products liability cases, that would be appropriate. The second bill is before you in this tort reform package that really is significant, and our organization promotes, and will, when that comes up for hearing, would expand more upon that, is the concept that where there more than one party or defendant who is alleged to be at fault, if you have one that settles out, how is that settlement affected? And does the remaining defendant have the right to take an offset or credit for that judgment? For many years, they did. There was some tort reform in 1995, and that law was changed a little bit. And Canley will be able to present some examples of why that has created some unfair results. So that's something that we're going to be promoting before this committee in the hearings next week. I listened with interest to former Representative Mannix's proposal for the no-fault medical malpractice injury compensation system. And Canley, I haven't had a chance to review that. Don't know how that would work. You know, Canley, in most medical malpractice cases, there are several things you have to prove. You have to prove a standard of care and a breach of standard of care, causation, and damages. And all those elements have to be proved by expert testimony through physicians who are knowledgeable in that area. I'm not sure how that would work in this compensation proposal. I don't think that you would take experts totally out of the system, because that is a complicated decision, particularly about whether a breach of standard of care caused a particular injury. So that's something that would need to be reviewed. Certainly would have to be voluntary in nature. You can't compel someone to abandon their right to a jury trial. But I think there's some real issues as to the timing of that voluntary enrollment. Is that something that takes place before you start the physician-patient relationship? If it is, it's kind of a heck of a way to start that relationship. Basically, come on, I'll be your physician, but by the way, if I make a mistake, you can't sue me. Why don't you do this? It tends to take a lot of the trust out of the relationship. But
Mr. Simon, I just point out that every one of us who has a brokerage account starts that relationship the same way with a stockbroker.
Yeah. Yeah, and you waive all claims to everything. Yes, you're correct.
You just waive your right to go into an NASD or a NYSE arbitration system.
I haven't had a chance to study this in great depth or detail. I just raised that as an issue. Certainly would be welcome to answer any questions that this committee would have. Would like to also comment that I think that because of members of our organization defend these cases on a day-to-day basis, we do have a kind of unique perspective and expertise to bring to this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Edmonds, were you going to add anything? Or
you know, I really wasn't.
Commentary.
I just would, again, echo what Bill said, that we welcome the opportunity to be here and be part of this discussion. One thing that he did mention on expert discovery or disclosure, our group has some division on that issue, and I want to be real clear that we are not necessarily advocating expert discovery, meaning that you would go and take depositions of doctors or other experts. We would, on the other hand, consider and possibly advocate for expert disclosure, somewhat akin to the federal rules, which allow an opportunity for the other side to see who the expert is and get an understanding of what their opinion might be, but not have a full-scale attack on that expert before they go to trial. Bill is correct that Oregon is somewhat unique. When you talk to other lawyers and other interested parties across the country, we have what's known as trial by ambush in a certain respect. You walk into court in state court without a lot of opportunity to see what the other side is going to present, and in the same way, we have certain things that we can hold close to the vest as well. We want this system to be fair, and if there's ways that this committee can open that opportunity up to be fair for both sides, we would like to participate and again, advocate for that. But again, thank you for allowing us to appear.
Thank you. We'll open it up again for questions, and I know that you'll be back next week when we start actually talking about the individual bills, and we appreciate your participation and some comment. I guess one of the issue of the expert disclosure was one that I was sort of interested in your take on it. And Mr. Simon, in your experience, do you think, as opposed to learning sometimes on the courthouse steps or when the person walks in the door during trial, if parties were to learn who each other's experts were earlier in the process, that it would lead to more early resolution of cases? In other words, do you think people would get the settlement quicker if they had a sense about who the other side's expert was and what they were likely going to opine?
Absolutely, yes, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely, yes. And under current rules, there's what's called a motion for summary judgment, where the purpose of that is to weed out the bad cases from the good cases. And as you're defending these cases, you may bring in an expert, say, we complied with the applicable standard of care and we didn't cause damage in this sort of case. Then in order to defeat that motion, all the plaintiff's lawyer has to do is sign an affidavit and say, I got an expert who says that there was a problem here, in essence. And you don't know who that expert is or what their credibility is or if it's based on good science or bad science or junk science. If there's early disclosure as to the identity of the expert and the substance of the opinion, you bet that's going to promote settlement, prompt an early resolution.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski.
You were given the two areas that you were thinking that we'll hear next week that you may have some interest in as a committee or as a group. I got the first one, which we've talked about a little bit, was expert discovery and disclosure. What was the second one that you mentioned?
Yeah, it's House Bill 2497. And what that would say is the defendant who remains at trial would have the ability to make an election if someone else has settled.
Okay, the election.
To apply the settlement proceeds and mount that settlement as an offset against any judgment. In essence, what that is intended to do is to prevent a double recovery. The plaintiff pleads and proves 100% of their damages. The remaining defendant gets a credit for what has already been paid in settlement and then pays the balance.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I wonder if staff, since this is something that looks like it took place in 1995, if there's maybe some history that we might be able to be given as to what the intent was for the changes that were made in 1995.
Well, I was staff in 1995.
Oh, yeah, I was going
to
say.
I happen to be here. Don't remember.
And I can't even give you... I have no idea what we kept with respect to what the intent was, but I'm sure that the office can do some research and come up with what was in the bill file at the time.
Knowing that I was here in 95, my institutional memory does not in capture of that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, in 1995, I also was appearing before this and other committees, and in that time I was in the capacity as a member of the Oregon State Bar Practice and Procedure Committee, and so I am familiar with those changes and why they were brought about and the compromises that were made at that time and at the appropriate time to bring that before this committee.
Could you bring that when you come back next week?
I'll do the best I can to dig through it and bring it in. Yes.
That'd be fantastic.
It's on the hard drive of a computer you got rid of probably about 3 years ago, Mr. Simon.
No, with my luck last week.
All right. Any further questions for this panel? Thank you. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Representative Anderson.
You had mentioned two things. First, I remember it was a cap on non-economic damages, and the second was that another cap?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, it was the expert disclosure rule.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here and participating. Next up, committee, it's an oldie but a goodie. I invite up Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council to give us our biennial rundown on Lakin and similar constitutional issues.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. My voice is a little lower today. I've got the cold that's going around the building, so if I'm not terribly sharp today, I hope you'll forgive me. You should be getting shortly here a handout that has what I would think to be the principal cases that we've been dealing with since 1999 when Lakin came down. Lakin was a case that was truly a groundbreaking case for the Oregon Supreme Court in that it, for the first time, it used Article 1, Section 17, the right to jury trial, in a very substantive way at all. There were no prior cases. Other states had taken the route. Washington had done it several years before as well, where they had looked at the right to jury trial and found it to be a limit on the ability of the legislature to do certain things that were allowed at the time the Constitution was adopted. It's an interesting case in that it was a purely historical analysis and has led to many other historical analysis from the Supreme Court over the last few years as well. What they did was they looked at the situation at the time the Constitution was drafted in 1857 and said, well, what could a plaintiff in a case do in 1857 as far as what kind of damages they could recover? And looking back then, there was no limit on the ability of a plaintiff as far as the amount of damages they could recover. And based on that, they said that the right to jury trial includes having a jury determine all issues of fact, not just those issues that remain after the legislature has narrowed the claims process. And based on that decision, they struck down the $500,000 cap on non-economic damages that had been passed in 1987, which was probably our first major tort reform session. At that time, that was I started on with the legislature in 1988, so I barely missed that one. I know it has the distinction of our office of being the single most amended bill, I think, in the history of the office. There was like 125 amendments to the bill. It was because they did the whole thing in one package, basically. I don't know what the title was, but it was probably pretty amazing. If you look at the bill now and go back and look at it, primarily addressed insurance issues. Everybody knows, especially after you having sat through the last 2 days of these hearings, the intimate relationship between insurance and the tort laws. And a lot of the bill was, in fact, directly addressed to insurance issues. But certainly the key piece of it was the cap on non-economic damages as far as the anticipated improvement in insurance rates for all claims relating to liability. So Lakin kind of put us in the position where it became apparent that it was going to take a constitutional amendment to do that type of cap, if you wanted to cap non-economic damages. And I should tell you, by non-economic damages, you're primarily talking about pain and suffering. You're talking about those things other than things like hospital bills and those immediate things that you can put a cash value on. So there's a definition in 18560 of what non-economic damages is. It's been a very popular definition and appears in a lot of other statutes now as well to help identify the types of damages we're talking about for those purposes. I should tell you, 18560 isn't totally unconstitutional. One of the strange things that happen when you look at it from Article 1, Section 17 is that because it only applies to things that were available in 1857, you're looking at what's known as common law causes of actions, those things that the courts basically recognized as opposed to causes of actions created by the legislature. And so anything that the legislature created, you can put a cap on it. And the one principal one that's of significance for 18560 is that wrongful death actions are statutorily created. I think they were created in like 1860, about a year after we became a state. The legislature passed a wrongful death statute, basically authorizing someone to sue for the death. Under the old common law, if you had a claim against someone, your claim died when you died, and you needed to have a statute in order to authorize it. So one of the weirder things about the Lakin decision is that the $500,000 cap still lives on, but only if the person who's injured dies. It's a rather curious thing. If you live, there is no cap, but if you die, the cap applies. And then, of course, any other of the statutorily creative actions that we have under the statutes also are still subject to the $500,000 cap. Item 2 on the outline makes note of ballot measure 81. I'm kind of glad the chair is out of here right now. I think this is a sore point for him. He worked hard on ballot measure 81 and on House Joint Resolution 2. You can see the language of it there under the first bullet. It was a very short proposal and did not fare well in the primary election in year 2000. It was specifically designed in response to Lakin and was an attempt to basically authorize the legislature to enact a cap on non-economic damages. I should say that on ballot measure 81, other language was considered for ballot measure 81. There were lots of different, a range of different options. It was phrased in terms of limitations on damages. Obviously, that could have been limited to non-economic damages, there were also broader proposals. But the one that went out is the language that shows under the first bullet. When Lakin came out, there was a lot of confusion. I have to tell you, this is still a very much an evolving area of the law. Not all the questions are yet to be answered about what laws are valid and what are not. We have had additional guidance since 1999 because of some of these cases that we're going to talk about here. But in essence, there are still a lot of questions about the legislature's ability to enact a wide variety of laws, not just ones relating to damages and civil actions, but also about laws just relating to liability of different people. The ability to, for instance, pass a law that says that certain people are immune from liability for certain acts. And we have literally dozens, if not hundreds, of those laws on the books that are still somewhat in question because of the Lakin decision. For instance, laws that say things such as a person who calls into a licensing board and makes statements about a licensed professional. We have many statutes that say that those statements are immune and that the person can't be sued for those particular actions. I think most of those laws are still in some question because of Lakin, and I'll explain as we go through some of these cases why I think that may be the case. Smothers versus Gresham Transfer is the third case on your list. The Smothers case was the first one to come down after Lakin that in a significant way took a look back at what Lakin had decided. I think it's interesting, and it's going to be interesting perhaps even more so because of former Representative Mannix's presentation relating to the workers' compensation model for a no-fault type of system. Smothers was a case in which a suit was brought that challenged the exclusive remedy provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act. The Workers' Compensation Act, when it first came down, was first adopted, and this goes back to like 1912 or sometime about then, I think, was when workers' comp was adopted in this state. There was a fair question when it came down about the right to jury trial. One that was raised in a case, I haven't got it cited here, but there was a challenge back in the 20s or the 30s to workers' comp based on the right to jury trial, and the theory was the same as the theory we had in Lakin, which was, at common law, you could sue your employer if your employer was negligent in some way, and you were injured thereby, employees could sue their employers. So the question was, when they adopted the workers' compensation system, they said, look, your exclusive remedy is the workers' compensation scheme. you cannot sue your employer. That's the exclusive remedy aspect of it. And the question at that time was, well, can the legislature do that? Because I had a right to jury trial in 1857 against my employer. How can you now tell me that I have to go through this other scheme? And I will tell you the case that came down in, I think it was like in 31 or 32, and if I think of it, I may even think of the name of it. Almost, it just said, no, it's constitutional. It had no explanation or nothing to explain to you the logic. They just said, no, it fails underneath that challenge. We're not going to discuss it. Some others kind of came back to that same argument, but in a very more narrow sort of way. What they were looking at were the reform things that had been done for workers' comp during the 90s, when an effort was made because of expanding costs within workers' comp premiums to try to keep those costs down. Laws were passed that tightened up the ability to make a claim under workers' comp. And one of the principal changes made by those laws to try to help with workers' compensation costs was to say that no longer would you be able to put in a claim based on showing that, in fact, that your work-related exposure or something that happened on the job was merely a contributing cause to your injury. In other words, that there was some contribution made because of your work-related exposure or some injury on the job to your injury. The law that was passed, and I forget if it was 95 or 97, whenever we did the big workers' compensation reform, said you had to show that it was a major contributing cause. In other words, that it was a far more substantial thing than just some contribution. It had to be a major contributing cause of the injury. The Smothers case, when it came up, because of the exclusive remedy provision, what that meant was is that if the work-related exposure or injury was not the major contributing cause, it was only a minor one, because of the exclusive remedy underneath the workers' compensation system, you were out of luck. You couldn't go to court for that contribution of injury, and the workers' compensation system wouldn't compensate you as either because you couldn't establish a major contributing cause. The Oregon Supreme Court in Smothers said you couldn't do that, that violated and now this is, again, part of this is not, this is an evolving area. Now we've gone past Article 1, Section 17, and we're looking at Article 1, Section 10, which is every man shall have remedy by due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation. And again, Smothers was a big step forward because Article 1, Section 10 had generally not been used in this manner either, although there's a long string of cases on what this language means. In essence, what they said was is that by prohibiting you from going after injuries that you suffered that were not major contributing cause of action, that you had essentially deprived the person's ability to acquire a remedy by due course of law for injury done to that person. So they said that was a violation of Article 1, Section 10. They said those people could sue. And, of course, there was a very strong legislative response. Something had to be done. I don't know how many cases actually of these actually show up in the courts, but it was certainly of great concern when the case came down. I think in looking at proposals such as former Representative Mannix's proposal, you may not have these same issues if you're not talking about an exclusive remedy type of provision. You know, from the discussion I just heard and from what I understand of what they've done in Virginia, the proposal is to allow people in advance to essentially agree by waiving right to jury trial before they start treatment or at some point to say, I'll go with this other route, which is different than workers' comp, although, because workers' comp just says by statute, this is your exclusive remedy. So there may be some difference there between the two. If you have this waiver, you may not be facing with these types of problems. But I think it gives you some idea of how far down within the details of the nature of your claim that the court looks in looking at 1857 determine what you have a right to. It's not just, do I have a right to go to trial? Do I have a right to get as many damages as I want? It's even such things as, gee, I could recover for any contributing cost of my injury in 1857, the legislature can't say that I can't go to court unless I can show it was, unless it was a major contributing cause. The nature of the remedy has to be fairly close, it seems to me, to what you had in 1857. That's what I think SMOTHER stands for. Any questions up to that point? It's dense stuff, and I understand that. Okay. De Mendoza versus Huffman is the fourth case that I have on my list. There was a lot of concern when Lincoln came down about several of the laws that we had on the books relating to punitive damages. A simple analysis of Lincoln would say to you, well, if we can't put a cap on non-economic damages, how could the legislature, for instance, cap punitive damages? And in fact, as part of the 1987 tort reform bill, there was a law, 18550, that says that you can't get punitive damages against a healthcare practitioner. De Mendoza versus Huffman basically relieved those concerns because the court took a look at punitive damages and they decided to draw distinctions between the natures of the remedies that you might have gotten in 1857. In the case of non-economic damages, they said those were the type of damages you got paid for injuries to you, to things that you actually suffered. The court looked at punitive damages in De Mendoza, and they said punitive damages weren't really designed to compensate the plaintiff for injuries that were done to them. Punitive damages were really designed to punish the other person, that they were not a compensatory type of remedy, they were a punishment remedy, and as such, they weren't subject to the same rules as non-economic damages and other compensatory damages were. Based on that, they basically said that, at least as I read De Mendoza, it basically holds that the legislature is free to do what they want with punitive damages. And I'm assuming at this point that ORS 18550, prohibition on punitive damages against healthcare practitioners remains a valid law. I think that that's probably safe. So that was and it also suggested that perhaps in looking at future other types of caps on damages, that perhaps there might be other damages out there that would not fall into the same category of protected type of damages or remedies, that there might be some that are of lesser importance than others. There definitely seems to be some sort of hierarchy, even though you could recover these in 1857 because of the very nature of punitive damages. They said we could do pretty much what we want with them. I should tell you that in De Mendoza, the specific law that was being challenged is we have a law that says that in cases where you can recover punitive damages, 60% of whatever's recovered is required at this point to be paid over to the Attorney General to be used for the crime victims assistance account. So basically, the legislature had a law that takes away 60% of all those recoveries now and uses them for crime victim compensation. And that was the law that the Supreme Court basically upheld in De Mendoza. In Jensen versus Whitlow, the last one, you'll note both De Mendoza and Jensen are very fresh. They're 2002 cases. They both came down in like August of last year. Jensen versus Whitlow is important, especially because of the many questions that I've received about possible use of the Oregon Torts Claim Act as being a way to respond to problems, especially with the Oregon Health Plan, where we have the problem with medical care being provided through Medicare program, Oregon Health Plan, and with physicians and the high cost of claims that are being experienced and the ability to continue to provide those services with doctors being unwilling to assume the responsibility with the increasing cost of the malpractice premiums. So the suggestion that I've heard from several members is, well, maybe we could make them agents of the state for purposes of the Torts Claim Act. And I should explain, the Torts Claim Act is the law that Oregon adopted that breached sovereign immunity. The old common law rule was is that the king could do no wrong, and so you couldn't sue the king, and that law applied to the state as well. The state was treated as equivalent of the sovereign, and for a long, long time, there was no ability to sue the state for torts committed by the state. The Torts Claim Act said, well, we'll let you sue us, but only within for certain limits of damages. And, for instance, for a single claimant on a single incident, it's like $100,000 for personal injury and those types of claims. And it's one of the reasons why the state's costs for insurance aren't higher than they are, because we have caps on how much can be paid out on any given claim by a plaintiff who comes in and says, I've been injured because somebody from the Department of Forestry or Agriculture, wherever, injured me while they were in the course of their employment. And so the natural thought is, well, if it works there, maybe we can do something for the doctors and try to help them as well. The Torts Claim Act applies to public bodies, just about everybody, all the public entities in the state, and their officers, employees, and agents. And so often the suggestion is, we'll just say, for instance, that doctors in the Oregon Health Plan are agents of the state, and then they'll get the caps on the damages. Jensen versus Whitlow, the fifth case, didn't take that on totally directly. It's not directly on point about the ability to put those caps in. It came to the court in a funny way. It came on a certification from a federal court. And what the certification is federal courts underneath our statutes are authorized to basically ask the Oregon courts for opinions about Oregon law for the purposes of cases that are before the federal courts, usually diversity cases where somebody in Oregon is suing somebody outside of Oregon for more than $10,000. And it's because the federal courts basically give deference to the Oregon courts' own interpretations as to the meaning of Oregon statutes or Oregon Constitution. And the question that the federal court sent back to the Oregon Supreme Court was, does the Oregon Torts Claim Act violate sections, three specific sections, the right to jury trial, Remedies Clause, Article 1, Section 10, the same things we've been talking about. And you may say, well, you know, the initial reaction to that might very well be, well, how could it violate those provisions? How could the torts claim violate? Because, you know, didn't you just tell us that the state under the common law couldn't be sued? And if you go back to 1857, again, all of these things are now done through historical analysis, looking back to 1857, if the state couldn't be sued in 1857, how could putting caps on the state liability in any way violate these provisions we've been talking about? Because you couldn't sue them at all. The problem is that in 1857, that limitation on liability really did only apply, generally anyway, only applied to the public body, to the state, or to the city or the county. It didn't apply to the employees. The employees were still on the hook for the full amount of the damages. So if this Department of Forestry employee was negligent while driving on the job and ran into somebody back in 1857, the liability of that person for their own negligence was unlimited. It was only the state or the Department of Forestry that you couldn't sue. So the question that Jensen was looking at is looking at the Torts Claim Act said, look, if you have a situation with an employee who is negligent, who is employed by a public body, you can't even sue that employee. You can't even name them in the complaint. They're off the hook. You can only sue the public body. And what the court in Jensen said was, well, we're not going to find that to violate Section 17 or Section 10 of Article 1, because you have provided an alternative remedy, similar to workers' comp. Workers' comp is an alternative remedy to what you could have done. And they said, we're going to find that the torts claim act, because you're allowed to, because the state has said you can sue us or you can sue the Department of Forestry or whoever, that's a good alternative remedy. And so that the Torts Claim Act in and of itself doesn't violate the Constitution. What they didn't decide was whether or not the remedy you had against the state was a constitutionally adequate remedy, because that's the other piece of Article 1, Section 10. Does the fact that there are caps on how much you can get from the state mean that you don't have an adequate remedy compared to the one you had if you could have sued the employee without caps? Well, the Supreme Court dodged that question very, very deftly. They said, well, you know, this case is down to us on certification from the federal court. There is no judgment. For all we know, the court may vary, the judgment in this case may be within the caps. And so we don't have to answer that question yet, and we're not gonna. So they took a pass on it. But certainly that's still lingering out there about whether or not, in fact, the caps that we currently have for the public bodies is going to hold up in the long run. If it goes, it will be expensive for the state, because in the states that have given up their caps, the cost in insurance for the state has gone up dramatically. In the context of tort reform and looking at and medical malpractice issue and looking at Jensen versus Whitlow, what this leads me to think is this. It isn't enough simply to say, for instance, if we passed a law that said that all doctors that provide Oregon health plan coverage will be agents of the state, that's obviously not going to be enough. You know, for one thing, most doctors are not going to say, oh, well, I can only get sued for $100,000. I don't need health I don't need to have liability insurance anymore. No doctor is going to go bare based on that promise. And so those doctors that are out there will continue to pay it, and it probably isn't going to affect their premiums either, because as a practical matter, Jensen would clearly seem to indicate that you have to provide an alternative remedy. If all you do is make them agents of the state and you don't say who's going to, you know, is the state going to pay, you're going to have to make them, in fact, the state will have to assume responsibility for those doctors and say, we will pay. We will pay. And then the question is whether we can hold the cap or not. And it's just a lot of problems when you start going down that line about how you're going to make that work. But one way you clearly can do it at this point, and again assuming that the caps stay in place, is to do what we've done with our biggest state-run healthcare provider, which is OHSU, where in fact the state runs, it is a public body. It's not a private entity anymore. It becomes part of the state. And in fact, the doctors at OHSU enjoy the caps that are in the Torts Claim Act right now. So looking at, for instance, Oregon health plan coverage, one of the options there to consider is that if you provide them through state, basically state agents, state employees, et cetera, and to the extent we can hold on to the caps, those sort of costs can be controlled. Moving this up to, again, going back to Representative Mannix's suggestion, the Virginia plan, I talked to an interim committee on these very topics last fall, and at that time, you know, the ask was, well, what can we do? What could we do within the existing structure of the law? And one of the things I did mention was workers' compensation. I said, if it's workers' compensation, I don't know why it doesn't work for other types of liability issues. Where if you can come up with an adequate substitute remedy. Now, there's going to be a lot of questions about what is an adequate substitute remedy, but workers' comp seems to be a system where they have taken a common law cause of action, the ability to sue your employer, and substitute a system whereby the person who's been injured goes through a different, entirely different remedy structure, comes up with entirely different benefits than they would get if they had gone through the court system, and yet has so far withstood challenge based on Article 1, Section 17 and Article 1, Section 10. The mother's case definitely indicates you're going to have to be careful about how you do it, because you can get burnt on even small details as far as whether or not the remedy is the same as what you had in 1857. But certainly that is the one thing that does stick out as being one of the one options that avoids these issues. The other ones, such as a return to a cap on non-economic damages, requiring the constitutional amendment in order to make those sort of things work.
Thank you, David. Are there questions for Mr. Hendricks? Early next week, colleagues, I'll be administering an exam on Lakin and its progeny. Those committee members that can score greater than 70% are allowed to remain on the committee. Those that aren't get their afternoons off. Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the peril of having to spend the afternoons here, I have been taking good notes. Dave, thanks. I wanted to just ask a couple of questions relative to OHP and the comments that you were making as it related, I believe, to Jensen versus Whitlow. And that is, if in the OHP plan we were to shift over from private positions to having people under OHP go into our county health clinics, and then physicians were basically going there and volunteering, providing free care, would that sort of automatically put them under the Oregon Tort Claims Act?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummel, it would. It would be an additional responsibility for the county because basically the Oregon Tort Claims Act is an insurance plan, is what it comes down to. Okay. It requires the public body to indemnify the person who's working on their behalf, and that works great. And again, I have to keep caveating here. You know, if we lose the caps someday, if we just can't have the caps, then it just becomes just like any other self-insurance mm-hmm. program for the state. The caps are the great advantage here because you can keep those costs down because of those caps. But yes, the answer is yes to your question.
So since it acts as a in that respect, then it would should actually be established as part of, if you're trying to establish a cost of care, then it should be established as part of the cost of care. Correct.
Yes, Representative Crummel. Okay.
And then, if I may, Mr. Chair, one more question. If a physician saw an OHP patient, but they also saw patients that were private pay, other third-party payers, and that sort of thing, wouldn't the only time that they would be covered under the Tort Claim Act be when they are actually delivering service to an OHP patient? So that if a third-party patient came in and was trying to sue the physician couldn't claim they couldn't make a claim under the Tort Claims Act.
Representative Crummel, that's correct, and that's the real problem with just saying, you know, any doctor who provides services to OHP patients are agents of the state for purposes of the Tort Claim Act, because if they have other patients, you know, obviously there are a few doctors, you know, who are going to go out there and practice without insurance based on because these few patients I'm covered, they still have to have the insurance for the other patients. So the only real question would be is whether or not claims experience would drive down the cost overall for all physicians. And because that's the one thing that over all of these years in looking at tort reform that's kind of been driven into me is that insurance companies don't change their premiums generally based on things that the legislature does.
They're
fairly hard-headed individuals, and they make decisions primarily based on claims experience. And they tend to wait to see what actually happens. And frankly, you can't blame them too much when you look at the fact that many of the things that have been enacted in many of the states over the years to help towards the cost of insurance have been struck down at some point or another. So generally, you are correct. It's not going to be helpful unless you are talking about people who are doing exclusively OHP-type work.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Prozanski.
Dave, you start off with your recent development of the liability limitation memo with the Lakin case. I was wondering if you could provide us with, I understand there's two or three cases that precede that decision that were through the Court of Appeals. And if you could summarize those for us, that would be appreciative. The 94, 95, I think a couple of decisions came down.
I'm not quite sure. There are certainly earlier cases on Representative Brzezinski, Chair Williams. There are certainly earlier cases on Article 1, Section 10, which related to situations where analogous type situations about adequacy of remedy. The Torts Claim Act has a provision that, in essence, denies recovery for wrongful death if you have a workers' compensation, a right to claim it under workers' compensation. And there was a very interesting case that came down on that to look at whether or not, because the workers' compensation benefit for death is minimal. As I remember, it's like $3,000 or something. You don't get that much if you die, as I remember, under the workers' compensation system. And so the question was is whether or not there was an adequate remedy. And most of these earlier cases, as well as it's going on in these, is looking at are looking to some degree about whether or not it's an adequate remedy. And as I remember the outcome in that case, the decision was that $3,000 was not going to be an adequate substitute remedy for death. That one there eventually got overturned on appeal because it was in that case where one of the lights went on up at the Supreme Court and they said wrongful death was not a common law right. It was purely statutory and it got overturned on appeal in a subsequent Supreme Court case. Beyond that, I think as far as the use of Article 1, Section 17, I think Lakin was the first one that came along that actually had reached this type of decision. Earlier cases where Article 1, Section 17 had been cited got very short shrift as far as there was one that was issued, I think, in the 80s where there was a challenge to the statute of ultimate repose mm-hmm. in the products liability cases, and Article 1, Section 17 was cited as a theory, and it got like one paragraph and shot down very quickly.
Follow up. It's my understanding that there were a couple of decisions that came out of the Court of Appeals or that differed as to the constitutionality of caps prior to Lakin. And I'm wondering, I don't know if it was looked at under the Article 1, Section 17 or not. I'll try to find that stuff because I've read through some of the material that the proponents or opponents have given to me, and I believe that there were a couple of cases that seemed to predate the 99 decision by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it seems like, Representative Brzezinski, it seems like in looking at these subsequent cases that come along, they don't seem to be backing away from the Lakin decision. I mean, they're tweaking it, definitely. The punitive damages exception is definitely a tweak. I would have probably looked at that and said damages are damages, but they said no, there's... So I think we're going to get some further evolution on it, but they so far they haven't backed away from the principle holding at all.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, David. We appreciate your time. We know you're busy. Our final panel... I would like to call up Corey Streisinger, Director of the Oregon Department of Business and Consumer Services, and whoever else she wants to bring with her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We know the afternoon is wearing on, so we'll try to be brief. In fact, we will be brief. I'm Corey Streisinger, Insurance Commissioner and Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with me here today is Meg Reinhold, who is Senior Policy Advisor for the Department, and also John Egge, who is Chair of the Board of Safe Corporation. And we were asked by the committee to briefly discuss the results of the 2002 Governor's Task Force report on professional liability insurance, and also have been given the opportunity to offer a few additional comments. The report has been handed out to you, I believe. I'm going to ask Meg very briefly to touch on the report, and then I'll offer some additional comments.
Thank you very much.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Meg Reinhold, and I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. You have in front of you the report that the Governor's Task Force on Medical Professional Liability issued in January, and you also have the roster of the membership of that committee. Things you need to know as you read the report, the first thing the task force did was really make a clear definition of what the problem actually was. There was some disagreement and initially about whether or not there really was a problem, and everyone came together and said, yes, there is a problem with affordability, availability, and stability of medical malpractice insurance premiums. Also, you'll notice in this report there's 27 ideas. The task force did not make recommendations because of the way the task force was constituted and the condensed time period in which they had to work. The governor asked them not to take any votes or try to reach consensus, but rather just go through all some ideas and brainstorm and come up with some proposals that could be part of a solution once we got into session. Also, you'll note that the task force didn't prioritize its proposals either, so each of them should be looked at separately and in light of the fact that there were no bills in print when the task force met, and so these are really just general concepts, and there are bills out now, and I think some of those bills differ in some ways from what those proposals are, and so they shouldn't be presumed to reflect what the task force looked at. Of the 27 ideas, only one of which had no opposition. That was the one that talked about a voluntary, confidential medical error reporting system. That came together particularly because of the voluntary and confidential nature of it. Relates a lot to patient safety, which the task force didn't spend a lot of time on, but thought was a good way to get at the problem. And I can answer any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions for Ms. Reinhold? I served intermittently on the task force. I was appointed, as was Senator Brown, to the task force. And it conflicted almost during its entire existence with the five special sessions. So it was difficult for the two legislative members to participate to any great degree, although I did attend several meetings. And I had Craig Prince from the Judiciary Office attend the meetings in my absence. And it was, I think, a good process, and I commend to you the report. There wasn't any consensus, I think it would be a fair way to describe the outcome, given the, and I'm not sure that, you know, as you point out, I don't know that there was ever any intention. But it is interesting, and I think if you're interested in looking at some of the potential proposals and lists of pros and cons, the report is an instructive piece of work, and it was certainly the division spent an incredible amount of time organizing and trying to make that process run efficiently and play a key part in that, and for that we're very appreciative. Is it your turn now, Corey?
I believe it is.
All right, great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, Corey Streisinger. And as Meg and the Chair have just said, the task force did not come up with any consensus recommendations to address the problem of medical professional liability insurance, but did come up with a consensus that there is, in fact, a problem. Insurance premiums in this area have increased very substantially over the last few years, and in some areas, as you know, medical professionals are now finding insurance to be actually unavailable at any cost. We have had 8 companies leave Oregon during 2002 alone, and over 70% of the coverage is now provided by just 2 carriers. The problem is most severe in rural Oregon, although it is statewide, and it's particularly severe for doctors who deliver babies. Currently, an obstetrician's insurance premium is about 6 times greater than the premium paid by a general practitioner. And I'm sure many of you saw the recent survey results from OHSU, which showed that about 1/3 of Oregon's obstetric providers say they plan to stop delivering babies within the next 5 years. And the survey showed that 22% of doctors who used to deliver babies have quit since 1999, and a large number of those are in rural Oregon. And this is very sobering news for anyone who is concerned about the vitality of Oregon communities. Without doctors, and especially without doctors delivering babies, it's very difficult for young families to locate to those communities, and therefore for those communities to develop the type of workforce that will spur economic growth. So the problem is a severe one, and one that we're certainly very concerned about in the insurance area. You have heard debate from other witnesses already about the causes of high malpractice insurance rates. The only comment I want to add is that this is a cyclical area, as in other areas of insurance. Nationally, as well as in Oregon, we have seen at least two other hard market cycles in the last 30 years, one in the mid-1970s and one in the mid-1980s, and we're, of course, in the middle of a hard market cycle now. The difficulty is we can't tell you where we are in the cycle. We can't tell you whether we're about to turn and come out of it or whether we're still on our way down and the market's going to stay hard for a period of time. But regardless of where we are in that cycle, the seriousness of the issue we face, particularly with respect to the disparity in rates paid by OBs and in some cases the unavailability of insurance at all, should be a major cause of concern and not one that could wait for the cycle to bounce back up. But the problem of a hard-to-insure population is not unique to the medical malpractice area. The legislature has addressed this type of problem in other contexts a number of times in the past, often by creating insurance plans or other risk-spreading mechanisms to make insurance available and affordable for those who can't obtain it in the private market. One example, which is administered by my department, is OMIP, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which was established in 1987 to provide medical insurance for Oregonians who have severe health conditions and therefore are unable to buy insurance in the private market. OMIP provides this population with insurance at a premium which is capped at 125% of the normal group rates available in the private market, and the difference between that premium paid by the individuals and the actual cost of providing care is spread by assessment among Oregon's health insurance providers, who then pass it through to the purchasers of health insurance in the general market. We also administer assigned risk plans in several areas, such as automobile liability insurance. These plans work by assigning each insurance carrier a share of responsibility for those who otherwise cannot purchase insurance. Another model, which I know you've heard about from other witnesses before you, is the State Professional Liability Fund for Lawyers, established by the legislature in 1977 when lawyers faced a similar difficulty in obtaining professional liability insurance in the private market. I'm sure you know that the attorney's PLF is mandatory for lawyers and provides insurance for all lawyers at the same premium rate. We do think a professional liability fund could work equally well for medical professionals, but some differences in structure might well be appropriate. For example, a medical PLF would not need to insure all doctors at the same rate, but a model similar to OMIP could be used, in which premiums for example, for OBs were capped at a specified percentage of the average physician rate so as to smooth out the peaks while still recognizing the different exposures faced by different groups of medical providers. And a medical PLF would also provide certainty and stability in the insurance market, much as a lawyer PLF has done. But we also think there may be another solution, which I want to talk to you a little about today, and that is to ask our public insurance company, Safe Corporation, to enter this market. We think Safe can bring several strengths to bear in resolving this threat to rural health care. And the first is an emphasis on prevention. When we faced a crisis in the workers' compensation system over a decade ago, the changes that were put in place included promoting a culture of workplace safety. And SAFE played a major role in that culture change, which we think has been remarkably successful. And we would really like to see a similar emphasis placed on patient safety today. The debate over medical malpractice insurance should not be seen as a trade-off between access to health care on the one hand and compensation for those injured on the other hand. We should be able to reduce liability claims and protect patients through a focus on patient safety, and we think SAFE's expertise in loss prevention can help. And, of course, SAFE also is experienced in claims management, and we see its size and market clout as a benefit. For example, SAFE may have considerably more leverage in the reinsurance market than our current providers do. We think this area is also a natural fit for SAFE since medical insurance premiums and the availability of medical specialists such as neurosurgeons are major factors in controlling the costs of workers' compensation, which is one of SAFE's statutory charges. We don't have details to give you today on how SAFE's entry into this market might work, but the governor has asked the SAFE board to give the issue serious consideration, and the SAFE board has agreed to do so. We hope to have a more detailed plan to put in front of you very shortly, and we look forward to working with SAFE and with you to see whether this can bring a solution to the problem of ensuring that rural communities have continued access to health care. With me today is John Agee, chair of the SAFE board, and I think he wants to say a few words about this as well, and then we would both be happy to answer questions you would have.
Mr. Agee, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, my name is John Agee. I'm the chair of the SAFE Board of Directors. This building has witnessed a number of opinions about what we are and what we are not, but what we are is a public-private, not-for-profit corporation dedicated to delivering workers' compensation insurance to Oregon employers and administering the Accident Insurance Fund on behalf of injured workers. I have very little to add to what Corey has said, except to say that the board has discussed this, and we feel that we, in our public duty, have something that we might be able to offer to this problem. One of the things that the board has is we have a couple of people who are on hospital boards. Myself, I've been active on hospital board for 12 years and recognize some of the problems that we're dealing with medical malpractice. And our CEO, Catherine Keene, is on the board at Salem Hospital. So this is an area that we have had some exposure to. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we have devised the silver bullet, because we all in this room know there is no silver bullet for this issue. But we're willing to put what effort we can into it. We're gratified that the governor recognizes that we have some unique skills in this area, and that our the staff at SAFE is maybe got an awful lot to offer in regard to this, some of the solutions that we might undertake.
Thank you, Mr. Agee and Ms. Streisinger. Can you give me an idea of time frame? I understand the board's agreed to look into the issue. How long do you think you'll need, Mr. Agee, until you've got some idea about the outline of a system that you would be willing to recommend to the governor?
Well, I will tell you that, Chair Williams, committee members, for the record, we are already talking about this and actually have kicked it around a little bit. But the mode that we're in right now is we need to gather some information. We need to gather it pretty quickly. We think that Corey's office can help us in that way, that maybe a lot of other private carriers don't have access to that kind of information, together with OHSU. So beating around the bush, as I am right now, I can tell you that we don't really have a timetable yet, but expect to have one soon, and we understand the urgency with respect to your schedule, and we want to try to accommodate that in any way we can. So that's an answer that really isn't an answer, but I want you to know that we're very serious about it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Agee.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add, we've got meetings scheduled this week with SAFE staff.
Okay. I noted by the – I can always tell when my committee wants to start asking questions, because everyone gets restless. They lean forward and adjust their microphones. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and I think Representative Ackerman was the first one to adjust his microphone, and then Representative Shetterly, and then Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I adjusted it rapidly because I have to be on the road in about 3 or 4 minutes, and I'm anticipating that drive, I guess. I had a couple questions for Ms. Streisinger. First was that, as I understood the testimony from Northwest Physicians Mutual, that they don't do any pooling of their risk. Is that your understanding of their business practice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's not a question I can answer off the top of my head, but I can certainly get back to you on that if you'd like.
Well, let me ask you this. There's no statutory prohibition against pooling of insurance risk, is there?
No, there isn't, sir.
Okay. And would we have the authority as a legislature to mandate that in our insurance code?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, there are actually a number of mechanisms that already exist in the insurance code for doing various types of risk pooling, joint underwriting agreements, and so on.
Fine. And I just want to say that I appreciate your testimony, primarily because you seem to emphasize a market approach to the problem rather than a legalistic or confrontational approach. And I would hope that some of the suggestions you made here today might be seriously considered by this body and by the Legislative Assembly. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll readjust my microphone.
Very well. Representative Ackerman, we know you have to get on the road, so if you need to leave, that's just fine. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's we've sure heard some interesting ideas today, and I think this is one, too, the last one to bring safe in. I was looking at this, though, in the Governor's Medical Professional Liability Insurance Task Force report of January 2003. I don't see safe as having been a consideration in the task force, so I assume this is something.
Mr. Chair, late Representative Federley, yes, this is late arriving. The governor, although this was the governor's professional liability insurance task force report, it is a different governor.
Okay, yeah. I understand that. I heard wind, I think, yesterday that something like this might be talked about today. Have you had an opportunity to discuss this with other stakeholders in this yet? I know we've heard from the insurance and the medical and trial lawyers, people who otherwise comprised the, this is what I was getting at, basically, the Liability Insurance Task Force. Have these participants had a chance yet to evaluate and comment on this proposal, or are they hearing it for the first time today, too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, this is something which has come together fairly quickly. We have talked to some but not all members of the task force.
Okay. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Yesterday, and you heard me ask this question earlier, but yesterday we had the presentation about Prop 103 out of California. Is that anything that that this task force by any chance took a look at? Does it appear to be as great as what the proponent was making the case for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carmel, I don't have any expertise to make an editorial comment about the value of Prop 103. I do know that the micro-reforms that were introduced, I believe, in the 70s and then reformed in the 90s in California were discussed, and several of the proposals reflected those micro-reforms. So there were several members of the task force that appreciated and certainly had the sentiment that some have testified before you that they were very effective.
Okay. Thank you. That's it.
That's it. Any other questions? Well, I would be very interested in when you get to the point of having developed your time frame, of giving us in the committee some indication of when you think you'll be able to come back and give us some additional information, and would welcome you back to do that. But also, because it is sort of a new concept that has just come onto the scene, strongly encourage you, Ms. Streisinger, and you, Mr. Agee, to engage with the other stakeholders in this process and get some sense of where their take is on this approach. And we'll be interested in seeing some more meat being sort of put on the bone, as it were, to get some additional information. But thank you very much for your testimony here today. We appreciate you coming in and sharing this unique approach with us. Committee, this concludes sort of the third day of the overview approach to this issue. There's considerable material that you've received. There's some additional material that will be distributed that some of the interest groups have provided. Next week we'll begin the process of looking at some individual bills. Obviously, we've heard some additional proposals today that are new and interesting, and I think we'll have an opportunity to talk more about those as well. But I'd encourage you to keep the materials at hand that you received and start making your own evaluation about those in reference to the bills that we're going to be having up for discussion next week. I appreciate all of you participating in the discussion. I think it's been very helpful, and look forward to continuing. So thank you, and we'll call the meeting adjourned.